you know, the Kremlin clearly saw Vladimir and his advocacy, his voice, as being a significant threat to their position and their authority. And of course, we saw the Kremlin do the same with Alexei Navalny just a couple of years later. What's interesting is that Bellingcat in 2020 did an investigation into the poisoning of Vladimir Karamurza and found that it was the exact same FSB hit team that was following Vladimir around for months before the 2015 and then the 2017 poisoning.
This is Cloak and Dagger, a podcast about OSINT, technology, and global conflict. I'm MJ Benias. This podcast is powered by Sapper Labs Group. For more, visit www.sapperlabs.com.
You know, clearly Vladimir, as I mentioned earlier, represented a clear threat to the regime and their authority. And that's, you know, this is how they decided that they were going to handle it, was basically to erase him and get rid of him and silence him.
These are war crimes that are being committed by the dictatorial regime in the Kremlin.
This is Vladimir Karamurza giving a speech to American lawmakers.
So very quickly, Vladimir Putin began to go after independent media, began to go after opposition parties, began to rig elections, imprison opponents, then murder opponents.
And Karamurza is a prominent Russian human rights advocate, a political critic and dissident, a very dangerous job in Vladimir Putin's Russia. His vocal opposition of the war in Ukraine and calling Putin's rule a regime of murders has placed him in harm's way more than a few times. He's been the target of multiple assassination attempts by Russia's intelligence service, the FSB, that left him in multiple comas and clinging on to life. Yet, he managed to survive each attempt.
So, last time I had met with Vladimir was in late February 2020 in Washington. I was in Baltimore giving a speech for Estonian Independence Day, talking about Estonia's struggle for freedom. And so we met, I think it was on the Sunday morning in Washington, just off of K Street. I think it was probably an Oboe and Pain or something like that. It was a sort of a French bakery. And it was sort of mid-morning. It was this really sunny and remarkably warm February morning. We sat down and we sort of just talked about our families and, you know, what was happening, you know, some of the travel that was coming up and some of our joint plans. You know, we talked about over a croissant and a coffee that morning, and you know, and Vladimir was kind enough. He had an old 1980s Oldsmobile that he drove around in, this big white car. And so he was kind enough to offer to drive me out to Dulles, where I'd fly out of Reagan, but I was flying out of Dulles that morning instead of having to take the metro and then the bus out to Dulles. Vladimir offered to give me a drive in the car, and so we drove. He drove me out. It was like it's a half hour drive, and you know, we talked about all sorts of, you know, Russian culture. I remember that we spent a lot of time talking about Russian rock music and how Russian rock musicians at the time were weaving in politics into their music, bands like DDT, and I think I mentioned earlier Yuri Shevchuk, Boris Grebenshikov, who were all quite critical of the Putin regime, but were legends. They were like sort of the Rolling Stones of Russia, but were at that point had been labeled as enemies of the state by the regime. So we had this great conversation about that sort of culture and trying to sort of promote those sorts of figures as icons of Russian culture in the Western world, and doing what we could to support them as well. But It was a lovely sunny drive, and that was really the last time I saw Vladimir before he was detained and now sentenced to 25 years.
Vladimir Karamurza is currently in a detention center in Moscow, convicted of treason for speaking out against the war in Ukraine. For the last century, Russia's attempt to control its global appearance and its people have earned it a troubling reputation. It isn't a secret that narratives are tightly controlled and that people have little voice against, frankly, a series of authoritarian regimes throughout the country's history. But that history is also full of people who expressed dissent, engaged in revolution, and saw through the lies being generated by state-run spin doctors. In this episode, I want to expand upon these stories. I want to understand the nuts and bolts of these mechanisms of control, and to tell the tales about those who throw wrenches into them.
My name is Marcus Kolga. I am a senior fellow at the McDonnell Laurie Institute, and I am the director of DisinfoWatch. I'm a journalist and a documentary filmmaker, and probably first and foremost, a human rights and democracy advocate and activist. I've been sort of working in the Russian space, so to speak, Eastern Europe, Central Europe, for around the past 15 years. And I've been lucky enough to work with some of the most preeminent sort of Russian dissidents and human rights activists of the past 20 years. People like Boris Nemtsov, who, of course, was a leading opposition figure until he was brutally gunned down in front of the Kremlin in February of 2015. I've been lucky enough for the past, 15 years to work with Vladimir Karamurza, who was just sentenced to 25 years in a modern Russian gulag hard labor camp. And throughout that time and in all of that work, I've obviously been keeping a very close eye on and have been personally exposed to Russian information and influence operations.
Marcus is an expert in psychological warfare, how governments basically use propaganda and disinformation to manipulate messages, to spin narratives, to tell stories that can alter perception. Because winning a war takes more than tanks, missiles, and bullets. You also need to manage ideas.
Around 4 years ago, 3 years ago, at the start of COVID, I was also lucky enough to receive some support from the U.S. State Department through the U.S. Embassy in Ottawa to start up DisinfoWatch, and the primary focus of that back then was to keep an eye on what foreign regimes were doing, how they were manipulating information about vaccines, about COVID, about various different lockdowns, and that sort of morphed into a broader sort of monitoring operation, looking at what China, Russia, Iran, how they were manipulating information in general. In the democratic world, and how they were exploiting some of the most polarizing topics in our information environment in order to divide us, and that work has really obviously intensified over the past 14, 15 months of this Russian invasion of Ukraine, because we've seen a significant intensification of those, at least the Russian operations, especially the anti-Ukrainian narratives, anti-NATO narratives. That have started floating around in the Western world and right here in Canada.
Since the earliest weeks of the war, the West and NATO have thrown their lot in with Ukraine. Russia's attempt to invade a sovereign nation is an obvious act of aggression, but with its constant targeting of civilian infrastructure and the mass killing of innocents throughout the entire conflict, the Kremlin's actions have only galvanized Western support and the provisions of military aid to the Ukrainian forces. And that support has significantly impeded Russia's ability. For the Russian state, it has then become imperative to stop this flow of weapons to Ukraine, and more importantly, to create a false image of the Russian state itself. The Kremlin must target the minds of people and politicians around the globe to convince them that this war is not only just but necessary, and that Russia is the hero the world needs and deserves. So how do they do it? How do they convince people that they aren't an invader that targets civilians and commits war crimes? Well, it boils down to altering the very ideological framework of reality itself. Truth and facts become malleable.
Oh, I mean, there are a few of these narratives, so there's lots to choose from. Look, first of all, I don't think that there's one, you know, specific or one single way that these narratives are initially identified, developed, and then injected into our information environment. I think it happens in many different ways. I think one of the sources is obviously inside the Kremlin. So inside the foreign ministry, there's, you know, their public affairs group. I'm sure that a lot of these narratives, especially the ones that are specifically related to Russian interests, since, you know, the war in Ukraine, a lot of these are cooked up right inside the foreign ministry. So that's one place where people are thinking about these tactics, the strategies, and specific narratives to put out there. And then, you know, if it's the foreign ministry that's doing that, generally someone will obviously put out those statements either in a press release or make that statement in one of their briefings or something like that. That then goes out to the various different diplomats and embassies around the world, and they're used quite extensively to push out those narratives. And then, of course, there are propaganda agents within those embassies. In Canada, we had an agent named Kirill Kalinin, who was operating inside of the Russian embassy in Ottawa up until around, I think it was 2018, when he was PNG'd pitching disinformation stories to whoever would listen in Canada, but to journalists.
Kirill Kalinin, for anyone who didn't follow the story, was a Russian diplomat who was ordered to leave Canada via, as Marcus said, quote unquote, he was PNG'd, otherwise known as being labeled persona non grata. Kalinin was officially expelled from Canada in early April of 2018, along with three other Russian diplomats. Kalinin was involved in the promotion of a conspiracy theory concerning some Canadian officials. They were involved in an anti-doping agency, and they were investigating basically allegations that Russian athletes were using performance-enhancing drugs during the 2014 Olympics. Kalinin would send out Twitter posts and emails to journalists, trying to seed stories in the press. In a fun twist, this particular case involved the infamous Russian hacker group Fancy Bear. They have ties to the Russian military intelligence unit known as the GRU. According to reports, Fancy Bear alleged that they had documents proving that Canadian officials were lying about Russian state-sponsored doping, and that there was basically a global conspiracy to have Russia kicked out of the Olympics. While the hacks were real and lots of data was stolen, they did not provide any evidence that Canadian officials were lying. Basically, they cut and pasted multiple email chains together, cut out entire contextual discussions, removed dates, and basically made it look like there was a conspiracy. And Kalinin fed it all to journalists, who, without doing any due diligence, published the stories.
And that was his primary role and duty. And unfortunately, in Canada, there were a handful of mainstream journalists at major national newspapers, who picked up on some of these stories and wrote about them. There are also fringe platforms who would work with Kirill Kalinin and the embassy to smear minority groups, you know, Ukrainian Canadians, for example. You mentioned this Russian state narrative that, quite frankly, has been ongoing for the past 80 years, accusing anyone of Central and Eastern European heritage that's been, you know, critical of the Kremlin of being a neo-Nazi. And in fact, they've smeared everyone who's pretty much everyone who's ever been a critic of the Putin regime has been accused of supporting neo-Nazis at some point or another. And so that's one pathway. So the foreign ministry, the Kremlin, out to, you know, various different diplomats, and then those diplomats or, you know, propaganda agents in the various different embassies would spread those out, amplify them, and pitch those stories to local media, whether here in, you know, Canada, South Africa, Europe, wherever those agents were located. The other way that some of these narratives get produced is within the Wagner Troll Farm, the Internet Research Agency, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with. This is an outfit that's based in St. Petersburg. It was founded by Yevgeny Prigozhin, who, of course, has now become infamous as the head of the Wagner Group and Vladimir Putin's, if they call him the former chef, because he made all of his money off of catering contracts to the Russian government. In the, you know, earlier part of the last decade, he set up this organization, the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg, a company, as it were, that employed hundreds of Russians who were tasked essentially with creating social media accounts, sock puppet accounts, using bots as well to within social media injects pro-Kremlin narratives and identify the more polarizing issues in our society. So issues surrounding, say, the environment, sensitive social issues, for example, and then promoting narratives both on, you know, whether it's the left or the right, but are on opposing sides in order to further polarize, exploiting those issues to further polarize our society.
Right. This is basically disinformation 101. You don't want to convince one group of one narrative. Rather, you want to convince multiple groups of narratives that fit into their already established ideological framework. So for example, if I am predisposed to think that something like climate change isn't real, well, you would provide content to me that galvanizes that belief system. On the other side, if I am someone who knows that climate change is a very real threat, well, you'd create content that weaponizes that threat aspect. You would amplify it and try to make it really scary. And then you would basically pit these two opposing ideologies against the other. You would create content or social media posts or videos or whatever that try to force people into conflict with the other. You essentially create multiple truths in order to sow chaos.
Some of these employees at the IRA would have, you know, hundreds, perhaps thousands of accounts themselves, which they would then use to advance those specific narratives. And if you multiply that over the, you know, all, you know, perhaps hundreds of employees, it's, you know, that's quite a formidable force. Those operations were apparently funded by the Kremlin. They were spending, close to $500 million annually on them. And so, these operations are well funded. They're well resourced, and they're quite effective. I should also mention that part of that entire ecosystem, of course, is RT and Russian state media. RT was, of course, founded in 2000. Around 2005 by Margareta Simonyan, who I think is probably also well known to your listeners. She's the head of RT. She made the suggestion to Vladimir Putin that Russia needs an English language service to promote its unique viewpoints on geopolitical affairs and advance its interests worldwide. And so that became a very important tool of Russian propaganda operations and disinformation operations in the late 2000s. And sort of grew. Now, of course, RT has been banned from most Western public broadcast systems, but it's still, it's still available online and through various different channels, Rumble and other video streaming platforms. So that's also an important tool in within that ecosystem. And then, when all of those narratives, so whether they're coming from, again, from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, from the Kremlin, through the IRA in St. Petersburg, RT or such, the other step in that entire process of injecting those narratives into our information environment, there's a constellation of proxy platforms that are used to sort of launder the Russian state origins in any of those narratives. So there's a platform Canadian-based platform that was identified by the U.S. State Department a couple of years ago. That's operated out of Montreal, called Global Research. This is one of those platforms that's not necessarily directly affiliated with the Russian government or with the Kremlin, but is very much aligned with their narratives and frequently and nearly all the time publishes narratives that closely align and support Russian state narratives on a wide variety of domestic issues here in Canada and mostly geopolitical ones. So these sorts of platforms will often reproduce or produce their own content that aligns with those Kremlin narratives. And then those are further used they're often injected into social media, onto Twitter, Facebook, various other platforms. And those narratives cater to often, you know, the far right, the far left, if we can call them that. These aren't traditional conservatives or traditional socialists that we talk about. They're more nihilistic, illiberal, sort of populist far left and far right. And those narratives are then often, like I said, advanced by those accounts. And sometimes from there, they make it into mainstream media. So over the past 15 months, we've seen the far right, certainly on Fox News, people like, you know, Tucker Carlson, unfortunately repeating a lot of these Russian state aligned narratives about Ukraine and such. So that's, you know, roughly the sort of flow, the rather complicated flow of Russian information operations and information manipulation in the democratic world.
Okay, so let's just pause here and just go through this. So we have formal government messaging from Russian sources. Sometimes these are put out into the world by diplomats who cede stories to journalists or on their social media accounts. We then have disinformation mercenaries, kind of like the Internet Research Agency, who make content and utilize social media to spin up their work via bots. We also have state-sponsored media, like RT and Sputnik. And we even have non-Russian media that act as mouthpieces for Russian disinformation. There's a lot of avenues here. You know, it's funny, this reminds me a bit of George Orwell's novel 1984. I can see my grade 12 English teacher nodding in approval. Anyway, Oceania, it's a nation-state in the book. It's constantly at war, and the novel's protagonist, Winston, he notes that the country they're at war with keeps switching, and the government assures the public that they have always been at war with that particular enemy, even though, like clockwork, they swap. And the public in the novel just accepts these dual competing realities as both being true at the same time. Winston, though, he wonders how it's possible that Oceania can be at war with East Asia for decades, and then moments later be told that they have in fact been at war with Eurasia for decades, only to be told later that it's been East Asia the whole time, and then back and forth and back and forth. So he begins to question, he begins to puzzle over this bizarre doublethink. How can both realities be true? The problem is that Winston and his protestations, they get him into some serious trouble with the state.
So I first met Vladimir Kara-Murza in 2009 when I organized a conference at the University of Toronto about Russia's manipulation of history. I was talking about disinformation before anyone else was paying attention to it, or that
it was a cool
issue, right? But Vladimir was, very much central to it. He understood exactly what was going on. He had been working inside the Russian opposition already for about 5 or 6 years, trying to organize civil society in Russia, certainly youth, to promote and advance the, you know, democratic values inside of Russia, which even back in 2009 was becoming a more and more difficult task, because Vladimir Putin's repressions, I mean, they already started in 2000 when he became president, but they really started escalating around 2006 when he basically the we from what we understand, the Russian government probably was behind the assassination of a journalist, Anna Politkovskaya, who was gunned down in her apartment flat for writing pieces that were critical of Vladimir Putin's war in Chechnya.
Three men were convicted of her murder in 2014. However, it remains unknown to this day who ordered her killing. I have to note here that in December of 2016, the news website The Intercept, they ran a story about a top-secret document that was part of the Snowden leaks, where it stated that the U.S. intelligence service, the NSA, was made aware that Russian intelligence services had hacked into her email account a year prior to her assassination. According to the leaked document, Russian intelligence services, and I'm quoting it here, deployed malicious software which is not available in the public domain. It is not known whether this attack is in any way associated with the death of the journalist.
And so in 2009 already, I mean, that repression was, like I said, in intensifying at that point. And I invited Vladimir to Toronto, and his mentor, Boris Nemtsov, was also participating in that conference. So Vladimir and I, you know, interacted throughout the past, you know, 10 years all the time. I arranged various different hearings in Ottawa for the legislation, you know, advocacy trips for them. And I would say that Vladimir came to Canada at least, you know, three or four times a year. And as I mentioned earlier, in, you know, 2015, Boris Nemtsov was killed. He was assassinated.
Thousands of mourners and dignitaries paid their respects to Kremlin critic Boris Nemtsov on Tuesday. The 55-year-old was shot to death late on Friday while walking on a bridge near the Kremlin with a companion.
Probably for his work exposing Putin's corruption, much like Alexei Navalny has done over the past number of years. And that same year, so Boris Nemtsov was assassinated in 2015, or in February of 2015. Just a few months later, Vladimir Karamurza was continuing Nemtsov's work and continuing to advocate for human rights and democracy in Russia, despite what happened to his mentor. And in May of 2015, he was having dinner with his father and became violently ill. He started, he just fell on the floor and started vomiting and was rushed to a hospital. And it turns out that that Vladimir was poisoned with a nerve agent, which we all believe to be Novichok, the same substance that was used in Salisbury and in the Navalny case.
Quick glossary check here, because I think it's important. Novichok, which is Russian, and in English it means novice, or in a more modern parlance, a newbie. It's a well-known family of Russian-made nerve agents. The science here is a bit complicated, but basically, this variety of poisons inhibit the chemicals in the body that allow your nerve cells to communicate with your organs. So if your nerves can't talk to your organs, like your eyes or muscles or lungs or your heart, well, they start to shut down. The Kremlin has used Novichok so many times that it's become a calling card for them, a sort of grotesque admission of guilt that serves as a warning, even though they deny ever assassinating anyone.
And he managed to evade death. I mean, it was very lucky that he survived. He endured significant nerve damage in his hands and feet. He wasn't able to walk for almost a year. I saw him. I hosted him here at an event in Toronto in February of 2016. He was walking with a cane. He was barely able to stand on his own. So even almost a year later, the damage to his nerves was really causing problems for him. But when I asked him, are you going back to Russia? He said, yeah, I have to go back to Russia. He was in his role as a leader of the democratic opposition, his place was in Russia, and he did return. He again was working to try and organize civil society, youth, to create a credible opposition movement to Vladimir Putin. And this obviously irritated the Kremlin, because they tried poisoning him again in 2017. The very much the same sort of situation. where he became violently ill, and this time he was able to get out of the country. He was able to recover.
I need to jump in here. I honestly don't know if I could do it. His mentor ends up dead. His allies and friends are getting arrested and killed. He himself survives two assassination attempts that, according to Bellingcat, have been perpetrated by the Russian FSB. I mean, what was he thinking?
After 2017, he came back to Washington. He and his family live just outside of Washington. He has three young children. And I saw him for the last time. I was in Washington in February of 2020, and we went and had breakfast. And I talked to him about going back to Russia and whether it was wise at that time, because then the Putin's repressions really had quite intensified. Navalny had been poisoned. He had returned. There was the protests that happened in Russia when Navalny returned, which were violently repressed. You know, young children were thrown into prison and beaten. And he said he has to return again. You know, many of his friends, myself included, were concerned that he would probably be detained. The Kremlin had already tried twice to kill him. It was likely that they would try that again. But sure enough, when the war began, he decided to go back to try and rally the anti-war movement there and civil society to oppose it. He spoke out on several occasions, both in the United States and when he was back in Russia. And the final straw happened in April of last year when he went on CNN and spoke out against the war, criticized the war. He returned to his apartment, and there was a team of FSB officers, police officers, waiting for him at his apartment, and they detained him because, of course, after the war, Vladimir Putin outlawed any criticism of the war, including the use of the word war in the context of what was happening in Ukraine, and this is initially what they were going to charge Vladimir with. It looked like he would be in prison for a short amount of time initially, and then that they would put him on an airplane and tell him to get out of the country and just send him back to the U.S. That clearly wasn't the case. Their plans were quite different.
Prominent Russian journalist and political activist Vladimir Kara-Murza has been convicted of treason and spreading disinformation about the Russian military. He has been sentenced to 25 years in a Russian labor camp as a result of the conviction.
In addition to charging him with criticizing the war, they charged him with treason. And so he was received a sentence for 25 years, which is more than most violent criminals in Russia get. You know, rapists get less time in Russia. And so he will be there. If there is no change in leadership in Russia, Vladimir Kara-Murza will be in prison for pretty much the rest of his life. His health has been deteriorating over the past 2 to 3 months. He's lost 40 pounds. The photos that I've seen recently of him, he's emaciated. He does not look well. His wife Evgenia has said that the neurological damage that was inflicted after the 2015 poisoning, the numbness that he had in his hands and feet that impaired his ability to walk back then, it's returning. He's experiencing severe numbness in his feet and in his hands, and so the situation is quite grim. And I think most of us, those of us who know Vladimir, and those of us who don't, but those of us who do know Vladimir are really concerned that he will not last 25 years. So we're very much hoping that the US government, along with its allies, can work out some sort of a proposal to swap prisoners and try to get Vladimir out of there, because, like I said, his health is deteriorating, and we're deeply concerned that he won't last very long if he's stuck in a Russian gulag for too much longer.
Is there a way of providing support? Is there a petition? Is there like anything like that that's kind of on the activist front that, you know, mm-hmm. listeners can do to help out?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there is a support page that is being put up. It's the October 30th Foundation that's being set up to support Vladimir's family and other Russian dissidents. And this is really one important way that we in the West, in the democratic world, can support them, but also governments in the democratic world. You know, there's obviously a considerable amount of stress when, you know, brave activists, dissidents like Vladimir are on the front lines fighting for democracy in you know, authoritarian regimes like the one in Russia. And when they get detained, obviously there's, you know, it's an incredible stress on their family. But knowing that their families, the families of these dissidents will be taken care of and are taken care of when they are detained. I mean, that provides a certain measure of relief for that stress. And so that foundation was set up to help provide some of that relief. And one of the things I've been advocating for, in fact, I had an article in the Globe and Mail just over the last weekend that also advocated for Western governments to do more, not just to support, you know, Russian civil society, independent media, but to support the families of dissidents and contribute to a fund like that, that will help support them and potentially enable and empower future dissidents to continue doing the work. Because if you can take that one element of stress out of that, out of their lives, I think it's extremely helpful for again, those sorts of brave dissidents who are on the front lines fighting for democracy in places like Russia, China, Iran, and beyond.
This story doesn't have a happy ending, and the work continues to help try and get Vladimir Karmurza home. I've included a link to the October 30th Foundation in the show notes, as well as to Disinfo Watch. I want to thank Marcus Kolga for appearing on this episode. Links to his work will also be in the show notes. A special thank you to Kennedy Chapel for her help producing this episode. For more news and information about OSINT, technology, and the conflicts that shape our world, please visit www.cloakanddagger.blog. I'm MJ Banias. Thanks for listening. Вопли Мариуполя по синим небом купольным. Свято место не пусто и давно куплено. Ластику власти, З значит свастика. Танки на праздник, русская классика. Пока стариков украшают лентами. Мы становимся иноагентами.